Hi, this is John Rowley, and this is the E Factor. And I want to be able to talk to you about joint health. Joint health, as I've gotten older, has become a critical issue for me. I had a very bad car accident, and I've had some issues with my joints. So I've been reaching out to Dr. Kareem Samori, and he's not only a good friend, a close friend, but he's one of the top experts in the world on joint health. Kareem, Dr. Kareem, how are you today?
I'm great, John. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you so much for having me. It's happy to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you being here and taking your time. I know you're busy. Can you tell the audience a little bit about your background and a little bit about yourself?
Sure, gladly. Yeah, I'm a doctor of physical therapy is my background in terms of, you know, my education, and I'm a kinesiologist for my undergrad, which is basically like exercise physiology. And I've basically worked in the intersection of those two fields ever since graduation or even before. I ended up starting a personal training company while I was in graduate school, and in order to work and also learn everything that I was learning, I found myself trying to apply everything I was learning for a rehabilitative or unhealthy population into a healthy population and just to integrate the information. And sure enough, the results were outstanding. You know, it turns out that the healthy body can take all of this info and take all of these maneuvers and techniques and incorporate them and actually get better results faster. So I was like, wow, there's something here and there needs to be this intersection, a continuum of health. So I went back and I approached the University of Miami faculty at the time and I said, you know, I'm really seeing this trend. What do you guys think about it? And their advice to me at the time was, you know, we generally don't advise somebody to get into private practice right after graduation, but we believe this is the future path of physical therapy. And if we were just 10, 15 years younger, we would be doing this ourselves. So we're encouraging you to get started as soon as possible. And of course, there were some mixed opinions because some people wanted more experience or this or that. And that's what we did. I graduated. My wife and I, we opened up Global Fitness LLC at the time, physical therapy and personal training facility. It was the first of its kind under one roof. We created an in-house master level certification for both personal trainers and physical therapists so they could speak the same language, integrate with one another, and understand how the techniques work and how they can actually see it as a continuum of health and refer back and forth to create the most optimal possible outcome, always prioritizing the most important system in the body. And, you know, this all started because I had a lot of pain myself, John. At age 23, I was in 8 or 9 out of 10 pain all over my body. I'd wake up, it was excruciating, and I didn't like it, you know. And I was just dating my wife at the time, and I wanted a bright future, and I wanted a chance to have a family, and I wanted my energy level to be there. And I went and I saw a doctor, and the doctor said, look, you got to quit physical therapy school. You have congenital ligament laxity. This is a trusted family physician, and your joints are just going to dislocate or sublux, and then it's going to happen again. And if we try and tie you up and sew it and make it tighter, then the other side's going to tear. So I don't recommend you exercise anymore. I don't recommend that you continue as a physical therapist. You should change your career path, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you can imagine, as somebody who's already graduated as an undergrad in kinesiology, who has entered his first year after applying the extra courses and everything else into his doctor in physical therapy program, who couldn't be more stoked about the entire concept, and whose motivation from the very beginning was to solve his mother's health, getting told this information, it was heartbreaking. And I went back to that faculty, and I told them, I said, look, you know, this is really good advice from a trusted family physician. I've known him all my life. It looks like I need to drop out. And what they did is they said, okay, I understand, you know, I appreciate where you're coming from. What if we, and there were a handful of them, what if we put together a program for you? We're never going to help you with it at all. And then you can give it a few weeks and see how you do in 30 to 60 days. And if you're feeling better at that time and you were able to take control of it yourself, you can make a decision whether or not to continue school. So I took them up on that offer. And sure enough, it turned out to be what I later termed a muscle balancing program, and then even later found out to be a body systems prioritization. And when I say that, I'm talking about your circulatory system, your nervous system, your respiratory system, et cetera. And from inside out is how I started to approach health. And what that appears to be doing, although it's always a learning process, is it appears to be standardizing results. So the 8 out of 10 people that get great results, well, how about the other two? What's up with them? And what I did is I said, well, let's just shift backwards, find their highest priority health issue, and then work outward from there based off of that primary system of their body. And sure enough, they started to get great results too. And that's really the philosophy and the angle that I look at health these days, always, of course, evolving and with complete humility intended. You know, I believe it's a new field, a young field, and there's a lot still left to be learned.
You know, I agree with you. Many years ago, I had a car accident, which you know about. And you recommended that I go to somebody that does not only rehab but myofascia. And the pains that I was having were in my neck. Well, it turns out the pains weren't coming from my neck. All my ribs and my breastbone were crushed, and basically I guess my breastbone was calcifying. So he's been working on that, and it's stopping the pull on my neck, so the pain has gone away. And why don't you discuss that a little bit? Because a lot of times the pain that we're experiencing in a certain area is actually coming from somewhere else, and I know that you do rehab in many areas, not just traditional rehab, but you do myofascial, you do other things. And one thing I like about you as well is that you encourage people to move. You believe in moving and creating health, whereas when I went through my car accident, they told me to sit down and not move and just kind of heal. So I guess the question is pain a lot of times, if you're having a pain in your neck or your lower back, that isn't necessarily coming from that area. Is that correct, or am I misunderstanding it?
You know, very often it starts central and works its way peripheral. In other words, it starts at the spine and works its way out very commonly. However, there's something in the body called a negative feedback loop, and the name's going to throw you off. But basically, if you can imagine that for every signal that comes from your brain through your spinal cord out to, say, your arm, there's also an equal signal, an opposite, that goes from your arm back to your brain to say, hey, this is what happens, so your brain can adjust for the next movement or position or whatever it is. And that's how your body knows and coordinates different movements, different pain signals, and all of that neuromotor response, if you will. So what happens is the signal can originate from the brain more commonly, or it could actually be feedback from the extremity sending back to the brain, and you really have to work that out. And then you have to figure out if there's an interruption in the signal stopping you from discovering the process. But when it comes to referred pain, it's important to understand the body as a whole, right? So what happens is this. If you hurt your shoulder, let's say, let's use your neck as the example. Let's say your neck becomes restricted and it's no longer having the same amount of range of motion. You go to turn your head left with your chin tucked in, kind of give yourself a double chin first to, you know, make sure that your neck's in the right position. You go to turn your head left, it turns a quarter of the way. You go to turn your head right, it turns three quarters of the way. Well, that's an asymmetry. And that asymmetry is going to work its way down in a diagonal pattern through your entire body, or up, depending on whether you're walking or sitting or looking or standing, right? And so if you go to take a step and that diagonal pattern of stress is already attenuated or tried to absorb across your body, perhaps your left heel is taking too much pressure. And maybe that means your right knee is trying to compensate, and your left hip, and then your right low back, and then your left mid back, and then your right shoulder, and then finally that left side of your neck, which is where we started in this discussion. So if we try and find that diagonal pattern and we try and make sure that there are no restrictions or limitations in range of motion, and then reprogram your body to understand where it is in space, oftentimes the gradual effect of daily living that leads to the breakdown and the pain signals and everything else with it goes away. And that is a miraculous aspect of the body. The body's connected. It wants, as a unit, to function, survive, and prioritize its highest priority issue first. It's survival. And every animal functions the same this way. You will automatically limp to be able to keep moving. Why? Because there could be a predator coming after you, and you need to be able to move. It's very simple if we think about it and we avoid the complexity of the human body and just think from a life perspective what gives us life in the most extreme of situations. That's what your body's doing all the time.
That's amazing. Now, in your experience, what are the biggest, let's say the top few challenges that most people have with their joint health? Is it knee problems, lower back? What are their biggest challenges?
Yeah, great question. Well, I can tell you some stats and stuff like that if it's helpful. You know, for example, 80% of U.S. adults are going to suffer from low back pain that needs to be clinically diagnosed at some point in their adulthood. That's 4 out of 5 people. At this very moment in time, over 50% of U.S. adults are suffering from low back pain. At this very moment in time. And that's just the ones we know about. If you were to take an MRI of the lower spine, and this is what makes it really confusing, and you were to take it for all U.S. adults again, you know, this is where the research is coming out mostly done, you know, that we take a look worldwide, you would see that, again, over 50% have herniated discs, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem. And this distinction becomes incredibly important. Is there a functional deficit? Is there pain related? Is there a symptom to correlate? And if not, then let's make sure that we're always strengthening and stabilizing, but not necessarily treating the things that don't need to be treated. So low back pain, to answer your question, John, is a big, big, big issue, and it's incredibly common. Next, I would say, are probably shoulders. And then after that, I would say knees and then neck. So if you wanted to take a look at the top four, I would say low back, then I would say shoulders, then I would say knees, and then I would say neck. But the good news is many times it's one solution that solves them all.
So a lot of times people who have knee, neck, and lower back problems, the core problem is one area.
Yes, and just to clarify, it could be just one of those problems. And it still could be, for example, the mid-back or the thoracic spine, kind of from like the top of your shoulders until the arch of your low back, right? So just in that territory, more or less, where your rib cage is and where all your ribs fit in, that area of your spine, because your ribs insert, becomes very difficult to move if, for example, you went to school growing up and you sat in a chair all day long. So I think a few of us could relate to this. And then we only had to look from our necks left or right. And now all of a sudden the mid-back area is heavily restricted. But then what happens? We live in a forward world. We reach and grab objects in front of us or overhead or below or underneath. We twist as we do it, and we tend to only move from a few segments of our spine, especially after so many hours of sitting because we're just a little bit locked up. You see, the body does an incredible job of trying to heal in a situation like this. And you might be saying, this is trying to heal. But the thing is this, you've fixated the body for hours and hours and hours into a single position, and your body is observing this. And it's saying to itself, maybe I need to stay in this position. So what does it do? It tries to lay down bone. It deposits calcium. It reduces range of motion, and it tries to fixate itself there. It may not be successful depending on your genetic history and mapping, but it will certainly make that attempt. What happens if we loosen that mid-back? Considering that it is about two-thirds of the length of the spine, you might argue that that would take strain off of above and below. And if we know that many of the signals start centrally and work their way peripherally or outward towards your arms and legs, then maybe if we stabilize and we mobilize right there, then oftentimes the rest of the signals end up making its way to the knees, for example, correctly, and your quads or the front of your thighs are no longer overworking compared to the back of your thighs or your hamstrings. And so even just loosening the mid-back for so many of us just because of our daily habits and lives can provide a profound benefit across the entire body. Of course, I don't mean to oversimplify. There could be an acute injury in any one of these areas that needs to be isolated and treated properly. However, there's something to be said for taking strain off of the body above and below the injury and seeing whether or not there's actually a real cause for the pain or your body was just compensating or redistributing the strain to that area.
That's fantastic. Now, just for the E-Factor family who's listening, anybody who's listening, we will be emailing out information on Dr. Kareem. This is just kind of an introductory interview, so you can get an idea. But so don't worry. You'll be getting things from Dr. K that will help you with this. But Dr. Kareem, let's take the top four issues that you spoke about. Are there things that people can do at home that will help alleviate the pain or at least get them going until they can find to work with somebody like yourself?
Absolutely. You know, and I actually think we should all take our health into our own hands, especially if you're subclinical. Let's say, and by subclinical, let's say this, okay? If you're not in acute pain right now, meaning you didn't just get injured or you didn't just have an acute flare-up of perhaps a chronic issue, and I mean in the last 72 hours or even, let's say, let's go back a week for safety margin. It's a good bet that you're completely in control of your destiny. Now, it's nice if somebody can work with you and spot it and help you fix it and see exactly what's going on. But you are in control. If you're not in acute pain, you're in control. And if you are in acute pain, you can exercise everything that's not and doesn't put pressure on it, and you'll heal faster. And you'll get out of that acute phase, and you'll take control back. So if we're to take a look at those four issues and just say, let's start with the low back pain because I just know it's just entirely too common, let's discuss this a little bit. Fundamentally, what goes on? Well, we sit, as I was saying, and that locks up our mid-back. But what else does it do to our hips? It actually shortens our hip flexors at our thighs, right, where it meets kind of close to our belly button, right? Our legs aren't extended and straight in that position, so the body tries to build bone there again. Well, the effect of that over time, if you shorten that muscle, because it actually crosses the hip joint, if you shorten it over time, that tendon gets tighter and tighter and tighter, it pulls your pelvis into a different position when you go to extend your legs. So now you straighten your legs and you stand up and your pelvis tips forward. Okay, well, we can counter-effect that by just tipping our pelvis backwards. So let's go through that exercise just so you have an idea about it. This should be safe for anybody. Of course, any recommendation that I offer you should always be checked by your physician and always by your physical therapist if you have any doubt or reason for concern. And the other thing that I want to mention, and it's not just so that I'm removing liability or something, this is truly for your benefit, you need to listen to this stuff, is if you're doing something and it's increasing your pain and it should be a normal movement, it's a really good idea to get evaluated. It's a really good idea to see what's going on. And by increasing pain, it could be symptom too, electricity in your legs, numbness, tingling, anything like that. Having said that, this is generally safe for almost everybody out there. Let's say you lay on your back with your knees bent and your feet flat on the ground. So you're kind of, you're laying flat on your back, head on the ground, shoulders on the ground, back on the ground, feet flat on the ground, and your knees are bent. From this position, what happens if you attempt to flatten your low back into the ground or squeeze your cheeks and hold for 10 seconds? Well, your low spine flexes and your pelvis does what's called a posterior tilt, or it tips backwards. Effectively, what you're doing is you're preparing it for some of the strain that it's going to experience when it goes to stand up. Now you move your feet a little further out, so your knees are still bent, but not nearly as much. Your legs are getting straighter, and you repeat on the next repetition. Then you move yourself a little bit further out, and you repeat on the next repetition. You just work your way out over 10 reps until your legs are entirely straight. And in this position, now you go to do your tilt, and you realize, oh my goodness, my pelvis has mobility even when I'm in this fully extended position. Those 10 reps of holding those posterior pelvic tilts for 10 seconds each and working your way from bent to straight could be a game-changing difference overall in the outcome of your health and the amount of pain or immobility that you experience. The second thing that I would suggest is loosening the mid-back, just as I was saying. Ah, sorry, one more comment on and John, please stop me if you have any questions. This is something I deal with every day. I don't mind any interruptions here, and I can certainly, just keep going at the time with the next thought. So,
if I've got a question, I'll ask. I appreciate where you're going, so I'm not going to interrupt a whole lot.
Oh, yeah. Feel free, though, I'm just saying. But in this case, when we loosen the hip flexor, we're actually going to reduce the amount of quad dominance, or the front of your thigh trying to overact and do all the work, and that allows your hamstrings to kick back in. See, those posterior pelvic tilts, people think about their hamstrings, and they think like behind their knee. But in actuality, the biggest muscle imbalance I've come across, I'm talking like 9 out of 10 people I see, regardless of what they come to me for, is a proximal hamstring muscle imbalance, or close to your butt cheek, right underneath that gluteal fold. Right there is where your hamstring starts, and that's what gets weak, and that's what gets out of position, and that's what gets sat on all the time, and that's the section of your hamstrings that ends up imbalanced. And when you can get that to start firing and working, contracting, counteracting that powerful hip flexor and the powerful quad, well, all of a sudden you have equal pull on both sides of your knee. When you have equal pull on both sides of your knee, well, your calves don't have to work as hard. Your foot intrinsic muscles, your arch muscles, they don't have to work as hard. Your entire arch gets restored, which is amazing to see. You decrease or dampen the stress into your low spine with every step you take by upwards of 20 to 40% just by restoring the arch, let alone the other factors we just discussed. And now, when your nerve goes to send a signal from your low spine all the way down to your toes, well, it's a lot easier for it to get there. All that tissue restriction isn't there anymore. There isn't one side always working harder than the other. There isn't something just locking up saying, no, don't pull harder, you're going to dislocate me. So that's kind of what happens below. If I'm able to move on here, and I just want to make sure I'm addressing any questions, John, I would next move to the mid-back. Do you have any questions about what I was saying with those posterior pelvic tilts?
No. In fact, I'm going to start doing that myself today because I've got some lower back issues.
Okay. Well, awesome. And I know, you and I are going to be meeting up soon in person too, and I'm always happy to be going over this information with you in person too. And I want to advise everybody, take the time. You take your car to a mechanic, right? Take the time. Go to a body mechanic. That's what physical therapists are in many respects. That we understand the mechanics of the body, how to integrate movement, and then most importantly, how to do something called neuromuscular reeducation, or re-educate the body to coordinate its own movement and sequence muscles in the right order to be able to stop this pattern of breakdown. So let's move on to the mid-back, okay? It's not just identifying how you sit during the day and telling you, well, you can't do that anymore, but it is a matter of saying, well, what can we do in 5 minutes or less per day in order to counter-affect what we do for a living or how we live or how we grow up? Well, small things like moving our mid-back. What happens if now you're seated and you cross your arms across your chest, you're sitting straight up, no back against the chair or anything else, raise your elbows up so they're at shoulder height, and rotate? Well, guess what? You're rotating your thoracic spine or your mid-back. In this situation, you can take strain off of your off of your neck or cervical spine. It can take strain off of your shoulders, take strain off of your low back, and then inadvertently, as a result, take strain off of your hips, knees, and ankles. So just by doing this movement, and again, checking for symmetry, you're going to start to understand whether or not you're restricted. So everybody do it with me now. Cross your arms across your chest, pick your elbows up so they're shoulder height, and rotate to your right, keeping your head straight, and then back to the middle. Rotate to your left, keeping your head straight, and back to the middle. If you notice that one direction moved further than the other, boy, you've got something really important to work on. The body craves symmetry. Solve symmetry, and you're going to solve almost any joint pain that your body could possibly experience, as well as avoid future injury. And that is, of course, outside of the chronic disease state and stuff like that. So now with the same exercise, instead of having your elbows at shoulder height, bring them down just a hair, like 1 centimeter. Try it again. Any difference? How about one more time? Another centimeter down. Bring it down. Any difference? And you can kind of gauge, based off of the height of your elbows, what area of your spine you're on. If you were to wrap around to the back, that's basically what you're attempting to move. And if you find yourself feeling all the strain in your low back, that just means you're actually going far and you've already missed your mid-back. So just nice and easy, abs tight, rotate back and forth, find the area that doesn't look the same left or right, even it out, and over time, see if you can get even further. But always cater to the limited side. In other words,
I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's pretty incredible. I was doing that. It felt good. But as you told me to lower my arms, I did feel differences on one side when I got to that mid-level. So this is pretty incredible. I never heard this before. This is incredible. And actually what I do is I work at a stand-up desk. So I don't like sitting down. So I work at a stand-up desk, which does help my lower back, I found. But just that one exercise you just showed me is phenomenal.
Awesome. Well, I'm really glad it could help. And, you know, I also work at a stand-up desk, and I have a comment about that. I want to just say that I added something. I just started working on a stand-up desk about 6 months ago. I'd never done it before. I stood up periodically. I'd done it for maybe like, you know, a week on or off, but it was always that awkward height desk that I'd gotten from IKEA or whatever. It just wasn't exactly a stand-up desk. It wasn't meant for that. So I just tried to get away with it. And now I have a true stand-up desk, so that my elbows are in the right position, they're relaxed at my side, it's the right height and everything else. And one thing that I found is as I'm standing throughout my day, a heel cushion was so useful. And it wasn't just under my heel because that would put my foot into a pointed position and change the mechanics of everything. But it was like a memory foam mat, like a doormat, right? A memory foam mat underneath my feet because of the number of hours that I was just compressing through my heels. And it completely changed the way that my body felt. Of course, I'm attuned to this stuff, so every day I evaluate for these different asymmetries and muscle imbalances. I just feel them when I walk because it's something I've concentrated on for a living. So I added this mat, memory foam mat, and it stopped any of that process from happening and actually kept my body loose, which is the advantage of the stand-up desk outside of energy level and other things. So I just wanted to mention that. But the last thing that I'll say about the thoracic spine and that mobility is right now I just instructed you to rotate left and right, but it's distinctly possible that it could be a diagonal immobility too. So if you could bear with me for just 1 second and try one more, let's get those elbows back up, arms across your chest. Now I want you to dip your left elbow down and in, kind of like you're squeezing your abs almost. And now I want you to up towards the sky, rotate up and to your right, diagonally, and then down into your left so that your left elbow tucks against your side. You shouldn't be curling your entire body. You're already moving from your low back. Okay, now switch. Your right elbow is going to be tucked against your side. Your left elbow is going to be in the air. You're going to rotate up and diagonally to your left, and then down and diagonally to your right, tucking your elbow to your side. Was there a difference in range of motion? If there was, this pattern matters too. And this is much more relevant to, say, when you go to extend backwards, which happens every time you stand up out of a chair, anytime you get out of bed, anytime you walk down the street, anytime you turn or rotate your head to look behind you. So you can imagine it's a pretty frequent outcome for your body, yet just that one little kink in movement could change the way your low back feels for the rest of the day if your mid-back locks up. And we got to keep that in mind because your ribs are there, right? If your mid-back is locked up, your ribs are holding them, holding that spinal segment in a locked position. And ultimately, what does that mean for your ribs? Well, they wrap around to your breastbone or your sternum, right? And so if they're locked at your spine, are they going to try and move at your sternum? Maybe. And that's not cool over time. But separate from that, you're going to have a harder time breathing. They're actually restricting your diaphragm. And if you start breathing from the wrong muscles, then you're going to end up in what's called a sympathetic state. You see, you have an autonomic nervous system. An autonomic nervous system is your fight or flight versus your rest and digest. Fight or flight is your sympathetic. Rest and digest is your parasympathetic. What happens when you breathe shallowly is it tells your body, I'm being hunted, and I need to sprint. And so what happens is your body releases all of the endorphins, the adrenaline, everything else, and now it's in the sympathetic state or hypersympathetic state over time, and it always maintains this fight or flight, never calms down, begins to have problems with digestion, irritable bowel syndrome starts to occur, and most importantly, deoxygenation to all the areas that need to heal. In other words, without the fancy terminology, blood carries oxygen and nutrients. And if you restrict blood flow by restricting oxygen, well, good luck healing. So this is really game-changing, separate from where your injury lies, just to make sure your body can restore circulation and oxygenation to all of the body parts and increase the speed of healing. So with that said, John, any questions on the mid-back area, or shall we keep going?
Well, with the mid-back area, once they do that, and I say they feel there's a difference, is there anything that they can do to compensate for that? Would it help it heal?
Just to clarify, when you say, let's say they feel a difference, excuse me, are you saying that they're starting to get loose and symmetrical on both sides? I'm not sure what you meant by that.
Well, say they do the exercise to the right side and they go a certain point with no pain. Then they do it to the left side and they don't move near as far and there's pain. Is there anything that they can do to help with that, or is this the exercise that they would do to loosen that up and work that area?
Great question. I meant to clarify. So, yeah, this is the exercise they would do, but you always want to cater to the limited side. Okay, this is it. And what I mean by that is you can't get more oomph where it doesn't exist. If your right arm is stronger than your left, don't lift more with your right arm. That's the easier way to think about it. If you're doing a bicep curl, you're not going to have a 50-pound dumbbell in your right hand and a 10-pound dumbbell in your left. That would look pretty silly and awkward. And you're not going to try and lift a 50-pound dumbbell in your left hand when it only has 10 pounds of strength, because you're going to hurt yourself, right? So cater to the 10 pounds on both sides, even if you feel, oh, I don't want to lose strength on the right. Remember, your body craves symmetry. And when you create that symmetry, you normalize nerve signals, right, to those muscles, and that's how a muscle contracts anyways, and both sides will progress even more rapidly. Every single time you'll get results faster by catering to symmetry. So in this example, we're not lifting a heavy barbell or a heavy dumbbell. In this example, what we're actually doing is range of motion. And if you can rotate more to the right and less to the left, well, you could push as hard as you want to the left, but you're just going to cheat that movement or substitute and try and rotate somewhere else from your spine. So instead, rotate the comfortable amount to the left and then imitate on the right. Repeat for 10 or 15 repetitions, and I guarantee you're moving further left. And when
That's
you do, stipulate on the right. Excuse me.
That's fantastic. No, that is fantastic.
Cool. Well, I'm glad I could help. That's a great question. So the next thing that I do want to mention to you is, let's say now your mid-spine's moving well. It's time, regardless of the exercise we're choosing and the area of the body we're talking about, to re-educate your body to hold this position. I have a lot of experience working with some world-class chiropractors just out of the luck of the area I lived in and the network I've been able to develop. And in physical therapy school and in chiropractic school, they seem to create arch enemies between these two fields. So for what it's worth, I'd like to solve this issue for you right now to the best extent I can. The main challenge, they say, with chiropractors in physical therapy school is that the chiropractors don't take the same oath as medical practitioners to do no harm, and so the business model exists, and it could be in their best interest to keep you coming in, and that gives a bad rap to chiropractors, but we all know there's human beings behind these titles, and many human beings want the best for you, and then some human beings are selfish, and that exists in any possible field. The second thing that gets said about chiropractors is that sometimes they practice outside of their scope as a result because there's a new billable service or it's an exciting new development, but not necessarily based off of research or evidence. So some of the things you see out there with the cleanses and stuff like that haven't been substantiated but are used commonly in chiropractic practices, and it's really easy to solve. You can just ask your chiropractor, you know, is this something that's based off of science or is it just something that you've seen work? And then you can make a determination what you want to do. Now let's flip it and talk about what the bad rap on the physical therapist side could be. Well, a lot of times what ends up happening is you need to be able to get the body moving really, really well. And only some physical therapists have training in what's called manual therapy or mobilization. A chiropractor manipulates the joint, right? So they'll get you in the perfect position. They are the world experts at being able to move that spine into an identical or straight aligned position. But then what happens after that? It doesn't get re-educated or held in that position. You see, only some physical therapists go and get the education in manual therapy, or it exists in the universities and they don't pursue it afterwards, regardless. And so they might think the spine's aligned, but it could be off by a millimeter or two. And so that signal strength really isn't there, even though it's thought to be. And then they go to strengthen in that position, and perhaps it's being strengthened in the wrong position. And that's what I want to get to with you. You know, you can gauge your own movement. You can see that you're symmetrical. And when you are symmetrical, it's time to train your body to hold it there. And that's really the big area where I started to work so much with the chiropractors in our area, was we would refer back and forth because they could in a second get the spine aligned. And many times there wasn't always a therapist that knew that stuff. This is an area that I personally had trained, but it wasn't an area that everybody did. And now the spine's in alignment. What do? We give them a neuromuscular reeducation program, which is a fancy way of saying we retrain the muscles to understand the right position and space for the body and how to symmetrically contract and hold them there. So the next step of your program after you become symmetrical is to reeducate your body to hold it. And the most important muscles are like your middle trap, your lower trap, your rhomboids, and your posterior deltoid. Now, all that stuff sounds fancy, but basically the back of your shoulders, in through your shoulder blades or your wings on your back, and then in between them into your spine. And those muscles will retrain your mid-back to hold itself where it is. And if you can do that while taking a breath in through your nose and out through your mouth while pursing your lips or breathing through a thin coffee straw, if you will, then what happens is your rib cage is expanding and contracting. The muscles are re-educating the spine to hold where it's at, but allow your rib cage to move, and there comes the oxygenation, circulation, delivery of all the nutrients that we need for healing. And that's kind of what I wanted to communicate there. And there are multiple steps and phases of rehabilitation I'd like to go over as well. But using this one specific low back example, I think you can start to get an idea how I haven't even talked about the low back and why this might make you safer at home.
That's fantastic. And you just keep going, because you're so beyond the questions I have. Actually, I do have one question. A lot of people suffer with arthritis. Do you deal with people with arthritis? And if so, is there rehab that you do with them? And is there supplementation that you believe in that helps in those areas, or with any joint problem for that matter?
Great questions. I love it. Yeah. So arthritis, there are multiple forms of arthritis. In fact, to my knowledge, there are over 100 forms of arthritis, and I believe that's a growing number, if I'm not mistaken. So out of them, there's osteoarthritis, there are a few forms, and then there's rheumatoid arthritis, which has tons and tons of variations, some that have a positive rheumatoid factor and some that don't. The fundamental difference between the two is local versus systemic. Local meaning in a joint or in a bone or in an area of your body, even if multiple, and systemic meaning in your blood, right? So no matter what you do, a capsule, you could wake up and your ankle's swollen, and it has nothing to do with anything you've done, and there's nothing that you can do to make it go away immediately. You can help the process, but your body's going to have to take that swelling back, deposit it into your blood or your circulation, send it back to your heart, pump it back out, and see if there's still a reason to be inflamed, because that's a disease state as opposed to a wear and tear type thing. You see, arthritis most often is osteoarthritis. In fact, it represents, I believe, over 90% of arthritis is this form, and it tends to be a broken bone in the past, a joint imposition, the feeling of getting older, whatever it is. And that's a normal part of aging. Arthritis or osteoarthritis is a normal part of aging versus bone loss. Now, bone loss, osteoporosis, that's not considered normal aging. It's not considered something that you're supposed to actually deal with. And I want to distinguish between these two before I offer any treatment suggestions or ideas. Because if you have bone loss, osteopenia meaning weakening bone, or you have osteoporosis meaning that you've actually lost the bone and it's hollowing out, then you are at risk anytime you increase the amount of resistance with an exercise or the weight with an exercise or the strain or you come crashing down on your body weight, you are at risk of a fracture. And that really changes the recommendations, because you can have an arthritic ache, but you could also have osteoporosis. And if we go and we add torsion or pull on that joint, it's possible you could actually create a fracture. And we need to be very, very careful to avoid that if you know that you have this diagnosis. Usually people know. If you don't know, you can get a DEXA scan, which is really useful. It's like a nuclear scan of the body, very, very low radiation overall. And what it does, it shows like a human skeleton with little red spots that light up, or hot spots. And that'll show you where you have arthritis, and it also can give you a really good indication of whether or not you have osteoporosis. It can be extremely useful. Once we've ruled out osteoporosis, or that abnormal aging process that very much can be avoided for many, many reasons, we can talk about that osteoarthritis. And osteoarthritis, for me, as an example, I have it in my left clavicle, my left collarbone, because I was born with a broken collarbone. 10 days later, it was healed. But fast forward 30-some years, and it's a little bit different now. And I can know when it's going to rain and stuff like that. So can you get rid of it completely? Almost. But not entirely, right? There are changes that take place inside of the body. But how do you get rid of it? Well, first, decrease inflammation, right? Secondly, try and redistribute the force or pressure. What other areas surrounding that body part could dampen the amount of pressure or shock into that body part? So in my example of a collarbone, or I guess for a lot of people, maybe we'll just shift over to the knees, because I know so many people have arthritis in the knees. Well, maybe your kneecap isn't gliding properly, and maybe it's rubbing or creating friction, and that's kind of producing a completely different strain inside your knee that's making you feel that arthritis. Well, let's get that kneecap gliding. Let's start to loosen your leg. Maybe you don't always have to lift. Maybe just loosen up a little bit. That's one example. What about like your femoral triangle, or kind of like on the inside of your thigh? If you were to take a look at your upper leg, begin at your knee, and come up roughly 3.5 inches, different on every person depending on your height, you're going to find an area called your femoral triangle. If you press in with both thumbs and you kind of search around a little bit and you find a sore spot, that's where a bunch of muscles intersect. And you know, John, how you were talking about myofascia earlier? That system of connective tissue has about 2.5 centimeters of slack in your entire body. So it's a connective web of tissue that gives your body shape or form. It's what holds you together. Most people think it's your skeleton. In actuality, it's this encasement of tissue. And over time, whether it's physical, emotional, spiritual, or psychological pain, or any combination thereof, your body will tighten and hold into position. If you've scarred down, it will use some of that fascia, and it might take up a half a millimeter here, a millimeter there. And when you run out of slack, the last place you run out of slack is the first place to become symptomatic. You have to work your way backwards. You have to restore your slack. And many times, the arthritic pains just go away because you've redistributed the force. You've stopped that pull from pulling on the area that was so sensitive to begin with, and your body no longer needs to use things like ligaments and bones to be able to stop you from dislocating or fracturing. It can use your muscles to dampen the force instead, because your muscles aren't being held down anymore. By loosening your body, by creating this extra slack, you're increasing the forgiveness of your body. And once you have this slack back, you can redistribute the strain easily. You can take all the surrounding musculature, you can divide it amongst it so that none of it starts to feel asymmetrical again. We want to keep things the same. And you can make sure to imitate anything you do on the left side of your body with your right, or the top of your body with the bottom, or the front of your body with the back. And then finally, anything that you do as you rotate left, you want to be able to do as you rotate right. And that's what true symmetry is. It's all planes of movement, top to bottom, front to back, side to side. And certainly the rotational stuff, too, because we live in a 3D world. Nothing's perfectly straight and aligned. And by doing that, we can take away so much of the arthritis. People say strengthen to get rid of arthritis. That sounds really, really simple. And it is, so long as your body's aligned and not pulling you or contorting you into a funny, twisted position. Does that make sense, John?
Well, that makes perfect sense. And I know I had cut you off and asked you about arthritis, and you're getting ready to go on to the other parts of the body. So you go wherever you feel you need to go. The goal of this recording is to have the people who are part of our E-Factor Diet family really know how to take care of their joints, especially as we get over 40, and how to be able to strengthen their bodies and live without pain. So I'm going to kind of set you free. We'll try to finish up in the next 10 or 15 minutes, but I'm not going to cut you off. You just roll with what you think is important, and then we'll wrap up, because I want to honor your time, because I really appreciate your generosity.
Oh, I love it, and I'm happy to be discussing this stuff with you. As you can tell, I have a lot of passion with this stuff. I really love it. You know, it's the difference between the quality of my life. It's not just the difference between quality of my life, but my whole community around me and all my closest friends and family members, and it's really the most important thing, right? Is health. Health creates happiness. I mean, you can not be happy even if you're healthy, but I hope that's not the case, and focus on happiness if you are healthy, because that's the most important thing. But before that, focus on health, right? Get your body feeling like you're young again, or most importantly, feeling normal again. So let's talk about what normal means and how you can kind of gauge if you're getting there or moving in the right direction. There's four phases of rehab. Phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. Go figure, right? And the first phase is the acute phase. The second phase is subacute, or kind of like after that initial insult or injury. And the third phase is return to activities of daily living. And then finally, the fourth phase is advancement or reintegration into society, advancement into sport, above and beyond where you were before. So you always want to kind of think about, what phase am I in right now? Am I still doing am I still just as limited as I was when I first got injured? Perhaps I'm still in that acute phase, even though I don't have the pain, because functionally my body's kind of in the acute phase. Am I starting to feel no pain or immobility, but, you know, I'm not quite sure if I can put a lot of pressure into my knees again yet? Well, then I'm probably in the subacute phase. And for every body part and injury, it's always a little bit different, the timeline. But generally speaking, if you're advancing at a relatively normal timeline, about 2 weeks per phase, 1 to 3 weeks, somewhere in that territory. And that's a good expectation for real change to take place. You see, if you're not feeling real change by the time you've done something for 2 weeks or seen a healthcare practitioner, it's time to switch. I don't care what they say, right? Like, I want results, and I want them now. I'm not trying to tell you that you should expect to be fully recovered in that time period, but if you can't feel significant change, I believe there's another answer out there for you. So let's talk about those four phases. The first phase, what wants moving to the next? Decreasing the amount of inflammation or swelling in the joint, making sure that you can move basic amounts within that joint, and most importantly, that you've redistributed the strain to other places to increase the chance of healing. In the subacute phase, that's when you're really going to start to move the injured body part. That's when you're really going to start to introduce very light strain. Even if, like, let's say, again, it's your knee and it's your right knee, you might take your left ankle, cross it behind your right ankle, and you might use your left to try and extend and flex your right knee, try and assist it in the beginning so there is no pain. And you provide the amount of assistance you need so there is no pain. Well, what are you doing? You're re-educating your body to start to say, oh, it's okay to move here, but just not with 100 pounds or 400 pounds yet. It's okay to move with 4 pounds right now. And gradually your body begins to accept this, realize that there's no reason to swell up again, and stop that inflammatory cycle. And that, once you have full range of motion, you feel like you can coordinate it properly, that kind of moves you into returning to activities of daily living. And again, this is all great to do in person with a physical therapist, should you have the opportunity. Always be conservative if you're doing it on your own. But having said that, now it's like returning to activities of daily living. Let's use that knee joint again. Maybe you're finding yourself putting a lot more pressure through your left leg when you go to stand up out of a chair, even though you've got the range of motion and everything else. Guess what? It's time to start practicing standing up out of a chair over and over and over again, 10 to 15 times in a set, and then rest for a minute and do it again. Pretend like it's your resistance or workout, resistance training exercise, or your workout, or any exercise you do in the gym. Just sit to stand, right? Little simple functional daily movements. That's what we do in the gym anyways, is try and simulate those movements. So let's go back to those movements when it comes to rehabilitation. Make sure you're fully functional there. Make sure you can carry out walking around the mall if that's a goal of yours without having to stop and sit down because you're in pain or out of breath or anything else. And once you've achieved that, well, if you want to go above and beyond whatever normal was for you before, that's phase four. Let's see whether or not we can just make you superhuman at this point. And just so that you know, in a physical therapy setting due to insurance constraints and other things, typically phase four never happens, very infrequently, and it's a catch basis. But I will tell you the way that you can achieve this if you do decide to go see a physical therapist. It's all based off of the goals that you set in the beginning. On that first day when they interview you and they say, well, what do you want to be able to do? What you say is your discharge point. Just, I'm going to repeat that. What you say is your discharge point. So it's justifiable to an insurance company, for example, for me to communicate that this person is a marathon runner, and that's what provides him peace and keeps everything going. And until he can run a marathon, he's not going to be fully functional again. It's justifiable for me to make that argument should his goal have been, you know, I'm coming to you because I can no longer run marathons. Now, if instead he says, I'm coming to you because I have knee pain, I have to discharge him when the knee pain's gone. So I never get to this phase four. And that's a really awesome secret to know about the way the whole system works, okay? And it's great. Your goals should be to be able to do at the very least what you could do before, if not well above and beyond, because if you're just doing what you did before, how are you going to stop yourself from getting injured again, right? You got to kind of think about that.
I agree, and I never thought of that. I never, you know, you have to be so careful today with insurance companies and everything else, and that's phenomenal advice.
Cool. Well, you know, it's all a matter of education, right? It's a complex system out there and stuff. So I want to first communicate these four phases of rehab. A really good way to try and assess where you're at right now is, are you swollen? Are you limited in range of motion? And to use a pain scale. And the pain scale is actually incredibly accurate just by the way that somebody responds to you. So on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 equals no pain whatsoever and 10 equals emergency level pain, how do you feel right now? And then you repeat the question to yourself. You say, well, how do I feel when it's at its worst? And how do I feel when it's at its best? And now you have three different pain ratings, and you try and describe what makes it its worst and what makes it its best. And now you have an association for what creates that, and you can start to identify, am I doing that? But ultimately, if you're finding that your pain is really above like a 3 out of 10, you're swelling up. Okay? So it's incredibly accurate to be able to tell you this. If your self-rated pain is above 3 out of 10, especially as it relates to movement, you're creating inflammation with almost 100% accuracy, I can tell you that. And if you're creating inflammation, you've just entered that acute phase, right? So we need to bring your pain level down below 3 before we can move on to phase 2 or your subacute. That's a really good way to understand it. And from there, it becomes much more straightforward because you know how you're moving, you know how you feel, and you know when you're ready to get back to walking, jumping, hopping, or whatever else you're interested in doing. And that's really important, right? How do you know when you're helping or hurting? How do you know when you're making forward progress versus regressing? Just by understanding these phases, it can make a game-changing difference. So before I move on to 9 different steps of rehab that I've been implementing, it's an adaptation of the education I received in my doctoral program. I just want to make sure to clarify anything that could be missing there for you, John.
No, Dr. K, you're covering everything. In fact, way more in depth than I expected. And I'm getting a ton out of this, and I know the listeners are as well.
Cool. Well, it's my pleasure, and let's keep going here because I think this is you know, there isn't too much more to this process. It may sound like a lot right now, but that's because I'm trying to lay it all on you, right? I'm trying to show you everything in an hour. So listen twice, 3 times, or 4 times, right? Because if you're empowered, if you're educated, if you know how to handle your body, every day for the rest of your life will be different. So I wouldn't be doing you justice unless I completed the picture for you. Let's talk about the 9 different steps of rehab that I use. First comes warm-up. Warm-up is defined by a point of breaking into a sweat. Oftentimes, for somebody that is injured or immobilized, that's not possible. And in general, it's recommended a minimum of 20 minutes warm-up. Very few people ever do that. It's really weird, right? Because everybody tries to skip out on it, yet it is the first step, and it's a really important one. Second comes tissue prep. Tissue prep is like specifically the area that's injured, making sure there's blood flow there. So whether it's a massage technique or something like that to try and just loosen it up a little bit, a stretch, something like that, that kind of comes next and really allows that body part to stop feeling so sensitive. Anytime there's a restriction, there's something called a nociceptor or a pain receptor that gets deposited there so that your body has a protective mechanism to say, don't move me anymore, I'm hurt. This body part needs to rest, even though the rest of my body parts can move, or the rest of my body can move. And so by just gently coercing this tissue to say, hey, are you sure you're hurt still? Those pain receptors get taken back into your circulation and they no longer exist. But the only way to get rid of them is to add pressure because they're pressure receptors. And so they only respond to pressure and typically it causes a little bit of pain, the good hurt, if you will, when you're getting a massage. After you do tissue preparation comes soft tissue mobilization, right? And soft tissue mobilization is kind of, it's the same thing as tissue prep, but more dispersed around your body. So if we were to go a joint above and below and make sure that the whole area is now moving nicely and all of the tissue is elastic and nice and lengthening, now you'd be in a position of strength and a huge advantage for your day. Fourth comes joint mobilization. Joint mobilization is generally not something you do on your own, so this may be a step you skip. However, if you're educated by your physical therapist or doctor, or physiatrist, chiropractor of how to do this, then by all means you can. What we're doing with the posterior pelvic tilts is in some way joint mobilization as well as re-education. what we're doing with your thoracic spine is we're rotating left and right is in some ways joint mobilization, right? We're creating symmetry in the way your joints rotate. If I were to do it hands-on, you know, I might actually put pressure on the spinal segment that is rotated, and that would be what you might more commonly understand joint mobilization to be. If it were my shoulder and I were to do it hands-on, I might again put pressure through my humeral head and my upper arm bone and try and restore the position of the shoulder. But if I were to do it hands-off or independently, I might grab on to a railing and then come up onto my tippy toes, holding onto the railing so that my arms are standing at my side, and it just distracts a little bit or creates a little bit of space in my shoulder, trying to allow blood flow back in there, separate the area that might be compressed, and relieve that arthritic ache that comes with many, many injuries, even though it may be pseudoarthritis. It might not actually be arthritis. It might just be the compression that's taking place that could lead to it in time. See, joint mobilization can still be very, very relevant for you, but if you're not sure and you're worried it could cause injury and stuff like that, that's one that can absolutely just get skipped over until you can handle it in person. Next comes neuromuscular reeducation. We discussed this briefly. This is step 5. Neuromuscular reeducation is, okay, now you've realigned things. Now everything's loose, it's warm, it's ready to go. Well, reeducate it. Teach your body to hold it there. How do you know which muscles to use? All of them. That's how you know. All of them, right? Take a look around your knee. Go up 360 degrees. Did you miss anything? Got to work it. How about your back? Same thing. What about your core? How's that doing? Work them all. If any muscle in your body is causing a pain in your area of injury, no matter how far away, guess what? It's trying to pull it out of whack. You better re-educate that body part too, but start closer to the area of injury and work your way out. Again, always catering to not increasing your pain, especially above 3 out of 10, because then comes inflammation. When we're done with neuromuscular re-education, we move on to therapeutic exercises, step 6. And therapeutic exercise is just exercise, right? But targeted specifically to do coordinative things or isolation-based depending on what's needed. I'm not a fan of isolation exercise as a general statement, meaning that I don't typically suggest preacher curls and stuff because it's easy to develop muscle imbalances. Sure, if you really know what you're doing, you can avoid the position and you could do the equal opposite exercise and stuff like that. But for the average person out there, it can really be a lot of strain in the shoulder, a lot of strain in the low back, and it can build bigger biceps than triceps and stuff like that. And so I generally try and avoid exercises like that unless I need to do very light versions just to reteach the muscle, and that's more on the education side. What I mean by therapeutic exercise most often is the stuff that involves your core, but you still have to move your upper and lower body, a squat and a press, a diagonal pattern, a rotational squat, a chop, a lift, any of these PNF patterns, if you've ever heard the term P as in Paul, N as in Nancy, F as in Frank, PNF patterns are fantastic for therapeutic exercise because they're coordinated. They force a nerve that sends a signal to 5 muscles to send a signal to all 5 at once instead of just 1 at a time. So selecting 1 muscle at a time, you're much more likely to balance in a very natural way for your body. So when we talk about therapeutic exercise, think about 3-dimensional movements. Think about things that involve multiple body parts and don't cause any injury there. And then when it comes to rehab in person, they're going to get really specific and exercise the injured body part too. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, can you exercise the rest of the body and get a result. And if I can just take a small tangent here for a second, John, I have a story to tell you. Is that okay with you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Please do.
All right. So during my time working at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, I at one point was working in the trauma ward, and there was a particular emergency, and at the time I was on an internship. I was still at the very end of my education, and it was a 6-week internship, and there was a very traumatic situation. The physical therapist got called out and wasn't going to be coming back for the rest of the day. That was my mentor. And so that physical therapist put somebody else there to supervise me but didn't have any background on his patient, brought in a patient that had been in a coma for 6 months, and said, you know, give it a shot. We haven't been successful yet. So I just sat there for like 2.5 hours trying to figure it out, non-responsive. I mean, this is a coma, right? But a coma, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a cringed up fetal-like position, tight. It looks uncomfortable. It looks really, really uncomfortable. And I started to think to myself, I said, man, this isn't a small amount of effort to get into that position. I laid down next to this patient, and I had seen pictures on the wall of he and his family riding motorcycles and playing volleyball and drinking beer in a park and having a barbecue. This looked like somebody that really liked, you know, like like thriving on life, you know, like really being out there, energetic all the time, doing all these crazy activities, and didn't look like somebody that was particularly lazy to me. So I had to ask myself, I said, well, what would I do in that situation? I mean, I'm not the motorcycle rider, and that's not, I'm not the beer drinker or barbecue or whatever, but I do like to live a very active lifestyle. What would I do? I would try my hardest to get out of that coma. So what I did is I laid down next to him, and I cringed into the exact same position. I could literally feel my muscles cramping. It was painful. And I said, man, I am trying so hard right now. So I talked to him, and I said, relax. Let me take charge. And I started communicating with him and saying, let me just try and move you this way, because your body will, it'll start to understand how to coordinate muscles instead of just choose the ones by accident that you're choosing. And I started to talk to him, and sure enough, his breath relaxed. And then his chest wall stopped expanding, or started expanding a bit more and stopped being so compressed. And then I started to just sort of coerce his arm out very lightly and gently using physical therapy techniques we know. And it started to straighten. And then his legs, the same thing. And then a physical therapist came running over. The supervisor was like, oh, my God, we have to cast this person right now. I said, what do you mean cast? I didn't have any experience in this stuff. They said, well, we haven't been able to get him out of this position for the last 6 months. How did you do it? And I said, well, I asked him to relax and told him to trust me and that I would do the effort, and he didn't have to because we have the same goal. And they said, there's no way he can hear you. I said, I don't know. I just don't know. But that's what I did, because I was left with him all day, and I had 2.5 hours staring at him. I tried to position him. It was like a cramp. And then we casted him into this straight position, and guess what? His body, after that, came out of the coma within 3 days, right? And so I started to say, well, these were these diagonal movements. These were these coordinative signals. This was the overstimulation. This was the hypersympathetic response. There's something here. This guy's trying hard to recover, just like I do when I'm sick, just like I do if I get injured. And it made complete sense. So when you think therapeutic exercise, don't always think aggressive. Think restoration. Think about diagonal patterns. Think about coordinative movements. And with that story, that's kind of how I always remember the importance of considering therapeutic exercise isn't the same as a workout that makes you sweat like crazy. It's the kind of thing that challenges you for that small little asymmetry that makes the right side of your pelvis dip when you do a plank, or your back arch a little bit, and you know it's not the right position, or your mid-back round when you're trying to do that same plank, and you're like, why is it rounding? Why can't I get it into position? Work on that position and holding it there, and then try your rotational planks if you will. And that's where therapeutic exercise becomes incredibly powerful. I'm going to continue forward here. Oh, please, John, go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to clarify. To the guy that was in the coma, it almost sounds like he was trying to fight to get out of the coma. His body was rebelling against him, which kind of kept him in the coma.
Yeah, I mean, the best way I could explain it, and I don't know, right? I mean, comas are very – they now use program, by the way. They now use the program. I had to give a whole presentation on it and stuff, and they've had really good success with it, which is awesome. I'm totally humbled to have been a part of it. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just really glad that it's helping these patients. But my best idea or hypothesis here is one thing we understand is true is there's swelling in the brain with a coma. And so if there's swelling in the brain, central nervous system, then there's pressure in different areas, and that pressure could interrupt either through the signal trying to go through the liquid of the inflammation, and that changes the way it communicates or conducts the signal, or perhaps it's shutting down one area that's trying to send the signal and allowing another. We think that, or I think, that it might be like sparks of signals being sent instead. So maybe in his mind he said, I want to stand up and go straight, but the only muscles he may have had access to were like his biceps and wrist flexors and stuff like that. And so the thought process being, well, what if he stops doing it because he doesn't have access to those muscles at the moment? And what if we start doing it instead because we have access? And then his brain, because remember that negative feedback loop we talked about earlier on? His brain sends a signal. It might be the wrong signal, but the body part sends a signal back that says, hey, brain, this is what happened. So sometimes we can re-educate in reverse, upside in.
What I tell a lot of people is, especially people who are depressed or having, you know, maybe mental issues, and not in all cases, obviously. I'm not even a doctor, but your physiology affects your psychology. So if your body's feeling a certain way or acting a certain way, it can affect the way that you think, react, and respond. So anyway, I just wanted to touch on that a bit, but keep going forward with what you're doing, because I'm loving it. Really bringing tremendous value to people.
Oh, yeah, and what you just said is so powerful. I mean, that brain is so, so powerful. We're just beginning to understand it. There's a lot more there. But moving forward, number seven is proprioception or kinesthetic awareness. Proprioception is position sense. If I close my eyes and wiggle my finger, how do I know if it's up or down? Proprioceptors, these little tiny nerve cells that help determine where my finger is in space. That's what ultimately helps you understand when you go to take a step, if you step too far, the same amount on the right or the left. And then kinesthetic awareness is just as it relates to really more dynamic movement, right? And so how much can your body adapt to that position, adjust, and end up the right way or the right length step? And so proprioception becomes really important. And the easiest way to retrain is something like quick kicks, if we're talking about the knee. And that would be if your right knee is injured and it's pain-free to stand on your right leg, then you would stand with your right knee extended and you just wiggle your left leg back and forth. And what you'll see if you're looking in a mirror is your right knee will have these weeble wobbles taking place. And that's increasing its ability to improve that negative feedback loop or send a signal to your brain, say, I'm right here, 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 I'm right here. And your brain will adjust and get better and better at restoring that signal. And that will increase what's called proprioceptive awareness or position sense. When your body knows where it's in, where it's at in space, it's going to have a much easier time preventing future injury. And that's why it's further along in terms of the rehabilitative steps. And once you have that, it's just reintegration, right? Reintegration then ultimately step nine would just be advancing. So reintegration step eight and step nine would be advancing or sports integration. And reintegration would be activities of daily living. Now that you know if you take a step that you went the same distance right or left, well, it's time to start going for walks, right? It's time to start standing up out of the chair and knowing everything's going to be okay. It's time to start doing, you know, lighter load activity or getting back in the gym and trying body weight only exercises and stuff like that. But when we get to step nine and we want to advance it, take your body above and beyond where it's ever been. If you haven't been living to your full health potential up till this point, it's distinctly possible you could be in the best shape of your life and you don't even know it, no matter what age you are. Because let's say when you were 35, right, and you're like, oh, my goodness, I'm not 35 anymore. Well, here's the thing. What if you were living at 20% of your potential at age 35 and now you're 65? Couldn't you be in better shape than you were at 35?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's huge, right? So never quit at step eight. Always go above and beyond. Test your body. There's a law, and a law means that it's proven, exists, it is the way it is, and it's called Wolf's Law, okay? And that law says that your body will respond to any stress or demand placed upon it. In a simple way of understanding what that means, it's why step aerobics build bone. The repeated impact causes your body to build bone. It's sending shock absorption. Your body says, ah, I know what's going on. It builds bone. If you go to do a range of motion exercise and you do stretches, you do it nice and slow and steady, well, you're going to find out your body's going to get better at it. If you try and advance your skill level with exercise or the amount of strain or intensity you have and go to that point of sports integration or total advancement beyond the scope of anything you've ever realized before, and you try and reach your body's full potential, guess what? It wants to get there. We're a living organism that wants to improve and survive. And if you just strain it in small amounts, controlled amounts that increase slightly over time, then you're using Wolf's Law to your advantage. And that's really, really important to understand, because your body will do miraculous things if you use small and regular doses of increased intensity.
That makes total sense, whether it's building your muscles or building your bones or doing the rehab. It's unreal. So what is the next step, or is that the final step?
That was actually the ninth step, and again, it's a slight adaptation if you were to try and learn it from another physical therapist or whatever, but this is what I've seen work the best in time.
And let me ask you this in closing. Number one, before I even ask that last question, is there anything that I missed that you feel like is important for our audience to hear? I know you could go on for hours, but if you have one or two things that you wanted to share in addition to what we've already spoken about, what would that be?
I think it would probably just be to summarize the information that we have here, because it can be a lot to take in, especially if you're in pain. It's a lot harder to concentrate. So let's talk through it in the simplest way possible. Advance through phases as your body tolerates. The phase one through four, from acute all the way through advanced. Redistribute strain to related body parts for increased function. If your shoulder hurts, what about the muscles around your shoulder? Can they help out? And then finally, work on the involved body part as tolerated, right? Don't try and do it all at once. And don't rest your whole body. Rest the area that's involved and injured, and then gradually increase the amount of pressure or strain that goes into it, never increasing your pain above 3 out of 10 or 3 points higher than where it exists right now. So if you're sitting at a 3, never beyond 6, because that the inflammation starts and the inflammatory cycle shuts down muscles, shuts down nerve signals, and really works against what you're working so hard to improve.
Well, Dr. K, I can't thank you enough. This is the E-Factor Joint Recovery Workshop, and we will be sending you out information on Dr. K. But Dr. K, what's a good website for people to find you at?
You know, I just try and make sure that all of the information surrounding health is free somewhere for people, because health is like water to me. It's something we all should have. So if you go to drkareem.com, drkareem.com, that's my blog. It's all free. It's all there, and I really hope I can help you. Make sure that you participate in the comments, because that's where it gets really exciting. I really like to customize these recommendations and ideas to you.
I'll tell you, Dr. Kareem, you're one of the biggest givers I know, a close friend of mine, and I really appreciate it. And just so everybody listening knows, I am actually going out to visit with Dr. K to have him work on my body to help me with some recovery myself. So I didn't bring on somebody who's just an expert. I brought somebody on who I truly believe in, who's the expert I go to personally, and lots of other of my friends do as well. So, Dr. K, in closing, I just want to thank you so much for being with us and really adding value to the E-Factor Diet community. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you so much for having me. And to everybody listening, believe, really believe, your body's capable and you can get there. Never quit, never stop.
This is John Rowley and Dr. Kareem signing off. Thank you for being with us today, and we really appreciate your time. And really hope that this brings value to you, and I know it will. Like Dr. K had said, listen to this over and over again. Let it sink in and start applying it, because nothing happens until you apply it. Thanks very much.